Group. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this is Latino USA coming to you live from Cal State Sacramento. Today, California, demographically, it's ahead of the curve. Latinos are nearly 40% of the population. And as the rest of the country catches up, we ask this question. Culturally, linguistically, economically, is California what the real future for the rest of the United States looks like? We'll find out today on our live recording here in Sacramento on Latino USA. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA, live at Cal State Sacramento for a history-making event, our first ever live Latino USA. So, why are we here? Remember this statistic. One-third of the country's Latinos live in California, and they don't all live in Los Angeles. There are wealthy, multi-generational Mexicano-Americanos from here, as well as new arrivals from Central America. So today, on Latino USA, it's all about California. So our first guest is a visual artist, an activist, and a California girl born and raised to talk to us about some of the big issues facing Latinos in California today and how it influences her art and her activism. Welcome, Fabiana Rodriguez.
Thank you.
So Fabiana, just briefly, for those people who may not know your work, how is it that you end up becoming a visual artist? What's your story?
Well, my family migrated from Peru, and like many migrant families, they wanted me to go into math or engineering. And when I expressed a desire to be an artist, they said, we didn't migrate here for you to be an artist. And it was very discouraged. In fact, I could only usually do art after school. And a lot of the art I learned was from the Chicano muralists. And I was really groomed to be a math and science student, and when I got accepted to UC Berkeley and I met a very well-known Chicana artist, Irena Cervantes, and she saw my work, she said, you know, this is what you have to do. You just have to, sometimes we have to break free from the hold of our parents and do what we love. And so since then, I left the university, I started a web company, and I just focused on art. And I think that art is a key tool that we have to not just reclaim our voice, but reclaim our humanity in a society that consistently dehumanizes us.
So it's interesting that for you, your art was really influenced by the state of California,
absolutely,
by the Chicano murals that you saw growing up. So
yeah,
for people who are not familiar with that part of cultural expression of California, describe that.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Oakland, which was also the home of the Black Panther Party. Oakland is where a lot of the Chicano organizing actually turned into institutions. And so I was going to a health clinic that was for Latinos. My education was bilingual. A lot of the funds that were coming through the California Arts Council, for example, were going to after-school programming for immigrant communities, which is where I was growing up. And the culture overall, the mural culture here in California, has been one that has, you know, stood out all over the country because of the traditions in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in the Mission, where murals became a way for us to kind of claim our neighborhoods, and also not to mention the relationship that existed many years before with the Mexican muralists in Mexico.
So you then become, your artistic expression leads you to a group called mm-hmm. Culture Strike,
yeah,
and it's a group of visual artists that mm-hmm. combine activism, and a lot
yes.
of your activism is around immigration. So
yes.
tell us about this group, Culture Strike.
Yes, well, you know, I think first, I started by launching Presente.org in 2009, which was the first online Latino national organization, very similar to Move On. And what was interesting is there had previously been no attempt to organize us online. And it's ridiculous because if you really think about our numbers and you think of the power of mobile and email, the fact that that had not been done, I think, is exemplary of just that there's not institutions in culture and technology that are reflecting our needs. And I think that culture offers us an opportunity to say what we're for and what, how do we visualize who we are as Latinos. And that's why I began Culture Strike as kind of a national initiative to work with artists, very high-profile artists and emerging artists, undocumented artists, to really tackle culture and to think of culture as a strategy. I think that often people think of artists as something that just happens or that somehow art is something that you can't shape. But I think that culture is so powerful that it can't go unorganized. I think that that has the power to eventually affect policy.
So behind us now here live on stage in Sacramento, we want to look at a particular slide. And this one is about UndocuQueer.
Yes.
So tell us what UndocuQueer is all about.
Yep.
And what this kind of symbolizes in terms of your marrying activism, immigration, and beyond.
Yeah, well, in the policy space, I think, you know, when we're looking at what Congress is entertaining, what kind of laws, I feel like we're looking at a very small sliver. There's racial justice. There is the fact that many in our community are queer and undocumented. In the policy world, we can't expect for all of those narratives to come out. However, in the cultural space is where you can have intersectionality. And if you look at, for example, the history of the term undocumented, which really started emerging in 2010, that was a challenge to the frame of illegal, right? And so young people were coming out and saying, no, we're not illegal, we're undocumented, and we're unafraid. And that narrative, by them pushing it, eventually resulted in a majority of the country in favor of the DREAM Act. Similar to that, there's a lot of queer undocumented youth who are owning the term UndocuQueer as a way of saying, look, politicians, you're not going to throw LGBT families under the bus, because being undocumented, in fact, has a lot of intersections with being queer, being LGBT, and that, and also speaking to the LGBT community, marriage is not enough.
In fact, that's what the behind us is a photograph, and there's somebody, they're holding up a poster basically that says, don't stop at marriage, queers are getting deported.
Right.
Most people don't necessarily make that relationship between gay people who are undocumented, who are deported and are suffering a whole other level. So you have, in fact, you're wearing a T-shirt that has a butterfly. It kind of looks like a monarch. It says, migration is beautiful. So, and you're using the butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about this.
Well, we are at a time of over 1,100 deportations a day. The anti-immigrants, which again, 1994 in California, Governor Wilson introduced Prop 187, and that set the motion for anti-immigrant state-based laws. So we've been under an anti-immigrant climate for almost 20 years, and I think that we are focused so much on fighting and on being reactionary that we don't think about, well, what kind of world do we want to see? How do we want people to view migrants? And very similar to the Black is Beautiful campaign, desegregation is not enough because we're being told that Black is ugly. So how do we say to ourselves Black is beautiful as a way to say we're resilient? The fact that our parents cross the border or are here without papers is only a symbol of their commitment to us as good parents, and is actually a beautiful story of how people survive.
Fabiana, why do you think that it's so important now for young people in particular, of any background, but of immigrant background, to make this connection with art as a possibility of expression, of hope? I mean, here we're looking at kids, four, five, 6 years old.
Yes. Yeah.
So you've taken this notion of migration is beautiful, and you're taking it into schools?
Schools, to teachers' unions, I mean, to the National Educators Association. It's no secret that the messages we get in the mainstream media are very racist often. They depict Latinos in a very limited way. And actually, even if you think about it, often Latinos are compared to cucarachas. You know, like even the subconscious imagery that happens when we're compared to something like an invasion or something that has to somehow be wiped out. Actually, I think think has consequences to our self-esteem, to our confidence. And so part of this is us of introducing positive imagery and stories and songs and images that reflect us is about us seeing ourselves and just learning how to love ourselves in a world that constantly says that we're invisible. You know, I think even with the 50 million Latinos, what was the last film you saw with a Latina protagonist? It is true that a lot of the majority of children being born in this state are of Latino descent. What books are they going to be reading? What children's songs? How are they interacting with culture? So we're, you know, I can go to a rally, I can go to a march, but the majority of the time I'm listening to music, in the car reading a book. If that content is not reflective of me, think about what that's going to be doing to my self-esteem.
So Fabiana, what do you see, just to wrap up, in terms of California, and what we can do, what we can all, the rest of the country can learn from California in terms of this expression of art and activism. Yeah. What are you seeing in California that the rest of the country needs to be aware of?
Well, I think that art overall is a way to reframe the narrative. And I think, you know, recently Governor Brown signed the domestic workers bill, for example. He signed the Trust Act, which means that ICE detainers, the fact that Obama had made mandatory for police and ICE to share data. And the governor just went in and said, no, for non-serious crimes, we're going to block that. And it's very indicative of the fact that California sets the trends. California has the power to actually have a ripple effect throughout the country. And where culture comes in is that we as cultural workers can help tell those stories. I don't think we should just work isolated in what's called the art world. I think we really have to look at how can we affect policy change? How can we help people think differently?
So behind us, we have another graphic, and it's a beautiful kind of reddish orange with block letters. It says immigration reform is central to women's equality. And you see three different women. What are you trying to say with this particular piece? And maybe you can describe it for our audience at home.
Well, there's three women, and they're looking very dignified. I mean, I, as a woman of color, I always want to show women is very strong and powerful. But, you know, three-fourths of migrants to the U.S. are women and children. And yet, you ask feminists out there, or even feminist outlets, are they looking at immigration? And they're not. And yet, immigration is a feminist issue. Immigration is a women's issue because the majority of migrants are women and children. And so how do we begin to reach out to fellow white feminists or people who care about women's rights to say, well, immigration is part of that as well?
You are doing in particular some work around women, domestic workers, immigration, and art.
Yes, well, the whole campaign called We Belong Together is something by the Domestic Workers Alliance, the national one, and it's around really reframing how people relate to their workers. If you are hiring a nanny who's Latina, how do you see her well-being, her workers' rights, as tied to the wellness of your family? If the woman you're working with has more rights, has breaks, gets overtime pay, she is better able to be a loving caretaker to the elderly or to your child.
All right, Fabiana, well, we learned a lot from you, not just about art, but about what's going on in your life and in your state. So thank you so much for joining us. Fabiana Rodriguez is a visual artist based in California. And to see the slides and some of Fabiana's work, you can visit our website at latinousa.org. Coming up, we're going to hear from poet Eddie Zazueta. Our very first live show continues here in Sacramento. Stay with us on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vaya. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, live at Cal State Sacramento, our first ever live recording. ¡Que viva Latino USA! We're very excited to bring to you our next guest. He's 19-year-old poet Eddie Zazueta, who's Oakland-based, and he's also a rapper. He's with us now to perform his song, Around the Sun. So please welcome Eddie Zazueta.
Life leaves me reminiscing. Days are spent under the sun. My youth is bright, succulent, juices are drunk while this fruit is still ripe. Listen, my ink flows in a silent stream connecting oceans. Dreams broken, shattered, and healed in one motion. Tides pull mistakes, push memories in middle of problems that solve anything and make the waves ripple as the moon glistens. I hear sounds from afar, musical windows to melodies, as I'm counting the stars, chasing forgiveness, only to keep my soul soft so my spirit hums of a forgotten love I once lost. Autumn leaves fall, shedding many shades of oranges. I kick back, relax, take sips from the pouring gin. Form harmony, smooth as lining, no denying. Horizon soothe my view when the sun rises. Hip hop is romance, these lips lock and slow dance. Hip hop is romance, these lips lock and slow dance. With lyrics that make you feel it when you play my dope jams. Hip hop is romance, these lips lock and slow dance. With lyrics that make you feel it when you play my dope jams. Said it's hip hop. Breaths of fresh air vocalize my sorrow in the breeze, exhaling whispers to carry in the wind when it speaks. The fragrance of life is an alluring aroma of romance, a scent you can visualize like an Aurorian dance. When midnight shaded sheets of lustrous silk fly on the canvas we call heavens, it embraces the skies. Gazing upwards beyond the beauty seen by my eyes, I kiss the rain whenever clouds continue their cries. Chant blue seasons are my sentimental beats from a drum, rhythmic repetition in headphones allowing music to bump. One with my pulse, a heart soundly embedded, binding eternal entendres in mirrors reflected together, never separate, synchronizing my message along with the life so rigid. I calm down the edges, flowing in the same river. On different courses we travel, our endings are similar for falling waters that channel. Put your tube, we unravel. Said these lips lock and slow dance. Hip hop is romance, these lips lock and slow dance. With lyrics that make you feel it when you play my dope jams. Said hip hop is romance, hip hop is romance. Hip hop is romance, these lips lock and slow dance. With lyrics that make you feel it when you play my dope jams. When you play my dope jams. En el área de la Bahía. Thank you.
Eddie Zazueta, thank you so much. Eddie is part of Youth Radio, a nonprofit media group that trains young people in various forms of media production. And Eddie will be back in a little bit with another performance. But first, we're going to welcome two guests now to our live recording here in Sacramento. Kim Nalder is the director of the Project for an Informed Electorate here at Cal State Sacramento. And Belinda Reyes is a professor and the director of the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State University. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
So, you know, when you talk about where we are, California, it is almost as if California is a kind of crystal ball. Nearly 40% of California's population is Latino. A third of the country's Latinos live in California. And essentially, the institutions and the culture of this state are changing all the time because of this demographic reality. So, Belinda, let's start with you. You know, you hear this over and over, this notion of, oh, Latinos are moving in, and why can't you just assimilate? Why can't you just learn English? So, in fact, in California, there's something that has happened around this particular ways that institutions are adapting to Latinos and their dynamic. So, can you give us some examples of what this state has done that stand out?
Some examples maybe in higher ed, in terms of institutions of higher ed, recognizing that most of the students that are coming through the pipeline are actually Latinos, and more institutions are becoming Hispanic serving. So that's changing the way we teach in the classroom, for example.
Was that a question of pushing for change? Was there resistance? How long until that resistance dissipated and opened up to opportunity?
I think the resistance is still there. I think it's a work in progress. Many Southern California universities are already Hispanic serving and have large numbers of Latinos. But towards Northern California, that is happening now. So it's a conversation that is happening in campuses as we speak, actually.
Beyond campuses, you're involved with something revolving around microfinance, around mission asset funds. What are these issues?
So this is thinking Latinos have some of the lowest banking of any group. They have very little, many people don't have credit, very little experience with the financial sector in the United States. So how do we create tools that are culturally sensitive, that are based on the culture and the cultural traditions, but still connect to the banking and the finance? And that's what that project actually did.
So how do you culturally connect to someone on the issue of underbanked people? Yeah.
So for example, many Latino communities have canastas or tandas that actually family members or friends come together and we share the pot. So I give you 100 and everybody puts 100 and you get it this time, Maria. Then next time, Kimberly gets it. So that's a tradition that has been in our communities for years.
And I bet some people immediately say, hold on a second, this sounds something like
a pyramid scheme.
A pyramid scheme.
Yes, exactly. So what happens is the organization, the innovation that they did was everybody now signs a promissory note that I promise to pay this debt to the organization. And everybody gets the backing of the organization that actually banks are now supporting this process. Now you could take it to the credit bureaus and it becomes a regular loan. So you start accumulating credit as if you were to borrow from the bank. And in fact, it's the community borrowing from each other that is producing this.
Kimberly, you're involved in the political side of things. And for a lot of people, you know, I'm thinking about Prop 187, Governor Pete Wilson, things mm-hmm. that even in my own family motivated my mom and sister in Chicago to become citizens. Sure. So paint a picture of what's happened from that kind of resistance to Latino immigrants to what's happening now in terms of political engagement.
Yeah, it's been really amazing. If you go back to the 1990s, that's really kind of a watershed time in California because we did get a series of initiatives that were backed by Governor Wilson that were really anti-immigrant, anti-bilingual education, anti-affirmative action. You know, this was a very bad time for Republicans to be taking on this sort of issue because it alienated a large wave of new voters who were coming into the electorate. So we had a lot of Latinos who were aging into the system and registering to vote for the first time, and we had people who were naturalizing in a larger group than we had had at other times. And so it created a situation in which Republican Party members were seen as hostile towards Latinos. And that sort of persists to today. And you can see something like that in the rest of the country with the immigration debates that are going on now, where, you know, there's an alienation factor that goes on. There's this historic sort of assumption based, I think, on a Reagan quote where he said that Latinos are something like Latinos are Republicans, but they don't know it yet. But if you actually drill down and you look at more recent polling data, that's not exactly the picture. They are more likely to be Catholic, but they're more progressive on actually a lot of social issues. They're actually more pro-gay because they look at it in terms of a family orientation. If I had a family member who was gay or lesbian, would I want them to have equal rights? They're more progressive on tax issues and on the activism of the government, how big the government is. Latinos are more likely to see the government as a tool for good, which is more in line with the Democratic Party. So if you drill down on issues, you actually end up seeing a Latino electorate that is more liberal in many ways.
So a lot of this is about basically understanding that the Latino community, if you will, of course, we know this on Latino USA, is incredibly complex. But that the message that gets put out there can sometimes be confusing. And I want to bring this back, Belinda, also to the question of education, because you hear about Latino students as having all of these negatives. But in fact, there are positives that Latino students, in fact, here in California are bringing into the classroom, like their social skills. What else are you seeing in terms of some real changes that the rest of the country can learn from California in terms of changing education and policy and changing the narrative?
The view of the student as deficient is an issue that we keep talking about in the campuses and in the schools. How you need to move institutions away from thinking the problem is the student to actually maybe I'm not teaching them right. and I need to change my pedagogical tools and the way I go in the classroom because it's not meeting the needs of this new growing majority. So those conversations are taking place, but it's still not the majority of the voices at the table.
This is a problem if you think about the fact that Latinos in the state of California are the fastest growing demographic along with Asians, and that many Latinos, it's a young demographic. So right. Wouldn't everybody want to be doing everything possible to make sure that this young emerging population feels enthusiastic about going to vote?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're trying to work on. You know, there are all sorts of organizations. I run an organization that's trying to do that very thing. But there's a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid because the young people aren't necessarily inherently interested in politics. And we need to, you know, target them and figure out ways to do that.
All right. So we want to open it up to our audience here in Sacramento in our live recording. So who in our audience has a question for our panelists? Let's take it to the audience. Don't be shy. Yay.
Hi, so I'm Josue Avedes-Mep. I'm actually the station manager for KSSU, Sac State Student-Run Radio Station here. So my question is, so I actually worked on a political campaign back in 2010 before I came here to Sac State. And so one of the things that I worked on was translating our script that we do going door-to-door so that way we can go to the Latino community in Stockton. What else would you think or suggest that we could do to outreach the Latino community to actually vote more?
I mean, there's even examples of undocumented cannot vote, but they have been doing also some walking into neighborhoods and saying, I don't have a vote, but you have one, and you need to vote for myself. Also making it clear what are the consequences. I started looking actually at Proposition 187 here in California that tried to prevent education and healthcare for undocumented immigrants. And if you look at that by race, most whites voted for it. That's why he won. But you look at Latinos, you look at Asians, you look at blacks, they didn't vote for it. But since they're not a large proportion of the voters, the initiative passed. So I think there's also a sense that my vote doesn't count. So recognizing in moments in which it has count and how much it has made a difference, I think is important.
I think it's important to realize that right here in Sacramento, that Latinos make up over 40% of the population right here in Sacramento. And that may not necessarily translate for people outside of the state, or maybe even within the state, that this city right here, 40% of the population is Latino. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. We have another question.
My name is Jorge Iñiguez, and I'm an engineer with Intel. Who's looking at the middle schoolers? It's a known fact that the dropout rates from high schools is high and is worse among Latinos. There was a program here in Sac State, and I'm not sure if it happened this year, where they bring middle schoolers and they have speakers that, you know, big professionals like me, you know, that, you know, have a similar background, and they speak to them. What can we do as a community? And if there are any other programs that, you know, some of us that, you know, are already in higher education can go back and help.
There are studies that show that just presenting the possibility of going to college makes a huge difference in young people's lives. I actually worked for a program before I got into higher ed that did that on a national level, where we tried to encourage students to think about college as an option. So many students grow up in families where their parents didn't go to college and didn't consider it, and just presenting that makes the difference. So there are programs that go out into the community and try to make them aware of those possibilities and bring them to college campuses, to have them tour the campuses, to get envision yourself on a college campus and pursuing a college degree makes a big difference. We have Children of Migrant Farm Workers program here on our campus that encourages those students to be here and to be successful and aids them in their transition into college. There are lots of programs that are working on that, but we need more.
There's also the family is very critical for Latino students and for Latinos. Our education is focused on the student itself, and we tend to go to the schools and talk to the student. But normally for Latinos, that's a family decision. So you have to engage the family, and you have to talk to the family about why this education is important. And then that has had some success. Also, teaching the parent. I mean, often the parent has had very little educational experience, so making them so that they look at the teacher as a person above them. So make them relate to the institution, empower them with the institution, I think has also been very critical.
So I want to say thank you to both of you for joining us on Latino USA. Kimberly Nalder is the director of the Project for an Informed Electorate at Cal State Sacramento, and Belinda Reyes is a professor and the director of the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State University. And thanks again for being on our live recording of Latino USA.
You're welcome.
And back with us on stage is Eddie Sasueta. He's a talented young rapper and poet from Oakland, California. And welcome back, Eddie. You're going to perform your piece, South Berkeley. Take it away, Eddie.
I grew up in South Berkeley, where grimy sewers used to run deep, drugs sold on corners, gutters filled with alcoholic streams. It was all love from my hood, black folks and Latinos, un barrio de juego, rolling dice more than casinos. My community witnessed everything. We never asked why. Hustle was in the job description, as we always shifted paradigms. People who didn't survive had souls that couldn't reach the sky. Some spirits were finally at peace, but not paradise. Innocent lives were lost, no longer a place of trust. As angels rose to see the heavens, they released us, dangerous. When bullets flare, a gun becomes hot. People probably pull triggers in hopes that their heart could be as warm as the barrel of a gun. Seconds without thought can kill an ego from afar. Be prepared, today might be your last under the stars. Ghetto kids used what we had. A few of us had drums, licking shots dusk to dawn, taking slugs to the lungs. Police only hear silence. The wax is dripping from Hail Marys, lit up, still in pieces. We pray to be protected, so we walk beneath the feet of Jesus. Cry when shards of steel reveal the person within. It takes broken pride to see the fear hidden under your skin. We were just children in an almost happy home. My moms and pops always made the rent and bills on time. My dad is tired. My mom is tired. They are sore. Years of work and struggle structured the pain held in their necks. This wasn't pride, it was sacrifice. So that me and my brother could grow up with one another. So that a hand could be given to me if my grip only caught wind when I fell and messed up. So that my hand could pull him down when he didn't know when to duck. Every day I walked out my door greeted by mostly blacks and browns in my neighborhood. On Prince Street, go a couple blocks down King Street and you were in Oakland. Corner stores weren't hard to find, and broken homes were sure as hell easier to find than the corner stores. Nickel baggies on my sidewalks, there was still hospitality everywhere. What's up? How y'all doing? You take care now. Block parties and occasionally flowers for the body police had bagged the day before. Being misunderstood was the daily routine. Neighbors I knew needed dollars. If you got a record, and it ain't even gotta be for murder, people will still keep you from progressing while you stuck flipping burgers. Whoever was hating would instantly turn into a target, stepping territory many would consider past enemy margins. My mother threw a party on the day of my father's birthday at a house next to a corner store on Oregon and Sacramento. Nighttime had come. Me and my brother walked out the house to get chips and a Coke from the store. We had no money, so we went back in the house to ask our dad for a five. 5 seconds after shutting the door, click, clack, and boom. After a while, you stop caring. They say money is the root of all evil. Greed is the seed. Society is the soil, while success is the product of what blossoms. Yeah, we got seeds of hope, but it's hard to water and plant them when all we got is liquor and cement. Where I live now, it's beautiful. Maybe I'll see someone from back in the day. Where I live now, it's gorgeous. I live in South Berkeley. Colored people pulled out, upper middle class pushed in. Let's just say my neighborhood went from a colorful canvas to a white canvas with a couple of watercolored smudges. I guess colors weren't in the budget.
Thank you. Eddie Sasueta from Youth Radio. Thank you so much. Thank you. And now, coming up, author Daniel Alarcón is here with us live with a story about a word that makes some people, well, uncomfortable. Stay with us on our live recording of Latino USA in Sacramento, California. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa in Sacramento, California, where we are doing our first ever live recording of our program. Now, we want to let you know before we start our next piece that it does contain some language that some of our listeners may find offensive. But in the spirit of open dialogue about race, we have chosen to include this piece. So now that that's been dealt with, back to California. Now, California has traditionally been a destination for new arrivals to our country. But the adjustments of migration are often difficult, especially as different cultures meet head on. And when you're young, facing so many changes, what you want most is to belong, which was the case for young Reza Salazar. Radio Ambulante's Daniel Alarcón tells us more.
Before he was 10, Reza Salazar had lived in Peru, in a half dozen towns in Colombia, and in northern Argentina, where his mother was born. He spent his childhood traveling until 1999, when he and his mother moved to the United States, to South Carolina, where they had some relatives. Let's just say it was not an easy transition. His first day at school says it all.
We're right outside of the classroom. We're just having a conversation right outside with the teacher, giving us a little introduction of class. And my uncle's there, so he's able to translate for us, for my mother and I. So when she goes into the classroom for me to follow her, I did what we do in Argentina. I poked my head in, and I say, "Hi!" And I waved my hand, and everyone started laughing. In Argentina, you are received with a song, right? When you come in the first day of class, the first day of school, people sing a song, a welcoming song for you. But in America, it was completely different. The American normal was very serious. And the less you say, the better. And the harder you look, the better. And you go to your desk and you sit. And that's it.
He suffered through that first year until it was time to move again. This time they went just up the road to North Carolina, to Durham. Reza arrived in the year 2000, just before a wave of Latino immigrants would change the face of that state. The North Carolina that Reza landed in had basically two groups, whites and blacks. Reza had to find a way to fit in, especially at lunch. At the school cafeteria, Reza had to make a choice.
And I remember going into the cafeteria, going through to get my lunch. And then right after I got my food, I was just frozen. One side was all white kids, and the other side were black kids. And then in the back, there was a little table with some international students there, like maybe a couple of Asian kids or and an Indian. And I thought to myself, where am I going to sit, right? And it was a few seconds, I guess. I mean, it felt like an eternity, but it was just a few seconds. And for some reason, I went towards the black table. And, you know, when you don't speak a language, you just observe and you just look around and you smile a lot because I couldn't go past my name is Reza. And that was it. So every day, you know, after I would just go straight to that table. At the time, I guess they were my friends, right, on that table, even though we couldn't talk to each other. They were wearing baggy jeans and Timberland boots, and they had cornrows. So I remember coming back home, like, the first few days of school, the first day, and I was, like, looking, you know, for, like, baggy jeans. And I told my mom to give me the Timberland boots, and I even got cornrows in my because I wanted to be part of it. And I felt like they were the ones who sort of opened up to me in a way, you know, just allow me to sit there.
Reza didn't know much about the place where he'd landed, not much about its history, its culture, but his uncle had sat him down one day, very early on, to give him the basics of life in the U.S., work hard, learn the language, and another thing.
I can remember he said, there's one word that you cannot say, right? And that's the word negro in Spanish. He said, you can't say negro because it's so close to the word negro, right? Or nigga, or nigger. Yes. So he said that word, but he didn't really give me an explanation, you know?
The explanation Reza never received was this. There are certain words that carry lots of violence, lots of history, too much history. There are certain words that open wounds. In this case, nigger is much more than an insult. It's one of the most offensive words in American English. Those two syllables drag an entire past with them, memories of slavery, of a brutal racism that forms part of the historical inheritance of the U.S., a history that remains very much alive, especially in a place like North Carolina. But Reza didn't know that. All he knew was that his new friends used the word all the time.
They would say, nigga, nigga, this, nigga, that, what's up, my nigga? And I was like, but that's the word that they told me not to use when I first came. And so I was very confused.
Die, nigga! Why your brothers and sisters are using the word nigga? Don't you know that's bringing down the black?
You can do what you want. Just keep it out of my neighborhood. I ain't no
nigga. But nigga without the R is something else. The total opposite. It's an affectionate word. The transformation of that terrible history. It's a word that African Americans have taken over. A word used almost exclusively within the community.
Why do I call myself a nigga, you ask me? Well, it's because mother...
So, you know, I've been sitting at the table and I've been hearing this word, this forbidden word that I wasn't supposed to say. And so every time I will go home, I would look myself in the mirror and I will practice it. And every time I will go to school the next day, I will be prepared and ready to say it, but I can never get around it. I was thinking, why can I say it if they're my friends, if they're, I'm part of the, I feel like I'm part of the group, I'm part of the family. But that was this one thing. For some reason, at 13, 14, it was the most important thing for me in my life to be able to be accepted. And I feel like I wasn't going to be accepted until I said the word.
One day, near the very end of the school year.
So yeah, I sat right next to the leader of the whole table, and I look up to him and I say, "What's up, my nigga?" And this 3 seconds, I'm... In my head, I'm thinking they're going to beat the crap out of me. Everyone's looking at me on the table. I said the thing that I wasn't supposed to say. And it was the longest 3 seconds. And then he looked at me. He says, "Okay, yeah. What's up, my nigga?" And I was so happy. I was so happy for the first time. I felt like I really, you know, belonged in a group in this country.
Reza Salazar didn't stop moving. Today he's an actor and he lives in New York City. Thank you.
Daniel Alarcón, thank you so much for that piece. I mean, that last moment when he's kind of like, I belong.
Yeah, I think that's why I was drawn to this story. You know, it's a story that makes me uncomfortable even to perform. I grew up in the Deep South too. I grew up in Alabama, so... This is not something that I'm accustomed to saying, but I responded to a story because moving to a new place is all about fitting in. And, you know, I know what it's like. An adolescent has to feel like they connect, and he just had to break this taboo that he didn't even understand.
So the work that you do with that kind of storytelling is part of a project that you conceived. It's called Radio Ambulante. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it's about storytelling, most often in Spanish.
Right.
This one you translated into English.
Yeah, we're lucky because Reza is, you know, because continuing to live in the United States is perfectly bilingual. Originally, when I met Reza, was in Spanish, and you know, he told me the story originally in Spanish.
That must have been a fascinating story to do in Spanish.
Yeah, it was. I mean, also because he's an actor, he's hilarious, and he's just a really, really funny guy. And also, it's just not a story. I mean, when we first conceived of doing this story for Ambulante, we also had to, you know, most of our audience is Latin American, so we have to explain, there's that section that explains the history that Reza didn't know, because our audience might not know it either. We get listens, you know, from Colombia, from Argentina, from Spain, from Peru, and, you know, they don't have the same racial dynamics that we have here, and much to say nothing of the history. Different versions of the history of you know, African peoples in the Americas, but every country is different. So we had to give the context in order for the story to make any sense at all.
So what made you decide, you know what, there's got to be storytelling in Spanish and I'm going to do this, even though you have a job, you're a writer, you're this, you decided to embark on this?
Yeah, I mean, originally what happened was I published a novel called Lost City Radio in 2007, and the BBC called me up and asked me if I wanted to do a radio documentary with them. And of course, I have a long history in my family of radio. My father was a soccer announcer. I have uncles and cousins who still work in radio in Peru. So I was, you know, immediately was like, yes, of course. And I spent 10 days in Peru traveling around with a producer from London. And it was a great experience, but when it was all edited, they kept some of the best interviews I thought were left out because they were Spanish speakers, because we interviewed people in English and in Spanish. And this was frustrating to me, and I started thinking, well, what would a space sound like if there, what would this piece sound like? How could this story be told? What would be different about it if it were told in the language that the people speak? But it really did seem to me that there was a space that needed to be filled. We want to create a space where people can tell stories in sound that that you might read about, but only briefly. You know, you might see the note, or you might not get the story, the more intimate personal story. So I'll give you a few examples. When on our first season, we did an interview with Manuel Zelaya, president of Honduras, and he personally told the story of the coup that overthrew him. So he personally, in his own voice, describes what it's like to be woken up with, you know, 100 soldiers in your house, and then, you know, summarily shipped off to Costa Rica in his pajamas, you know? And he tells it and he's laughing, you know, and it's funny. And so he's telling this humorous story that, you know, where the entire future of a nation hangs in the balance. But we've told stories, you know, we did a couple of pieces about human trafficking last year, one about the Korean mafia in Buenos Aires, you know, shipping Chinese migrants to the United States through the Buenos Aires airport. You know, for me personally, living here in California and in San Francisco, Radio Ambulante is a way for me to stay connected to Latin America. You know, I mean, I travel a lot back home and all over, but, you know, I get really in depth with these stories and work very closely with the producers, along with the rest of the team, of course. You know, I feel like I'm constantly learning and learning and learning, which, you know what that's like. It's just exciting. It keeps you alive. It's incredibly fulfilling to be able to.
Well, radio
be part
can
of
definitely
stories.
Be a lot of fun because here we are doing live radio.
Exactly.
And having a great time, no?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your novel, your latest novel, At Night We Walk in Circles. It's a wonderful book. It's about a young man named Nelson in an unnamed Latin American country. He's an avant-garde theater troupe. He's part of an avant-garde theater troupe that is reviving a play that is basically a political allegory. But and of course they go and they tour this into rural villages. There's a lot more that happens in this wonderful novel. But give our audience a sense of the story behind At Night We Walk in Circles.
Well, you know,
and you can't reveal too much.
This novel took me 7 years to write, so describing it hopefully will be a little more efficient. the protagonist is named Nelson, as you said. He's an actor and he's from a family. His father's passed away. He's sort of living in the city, taking care of his mother. He's never really left the city, although he has a brother living in the United States. He joins up this theater troupe and goes off to perform, and his life changes in a number of ways, as you described. For me, I was really interested in the theater, and I was really interested in reading plays, and I was really interested in particular in theater in Peru during that time of the war. I had the good fortune of meeting some playwrights and some actors from a group called Septiembre that performed back in the 80s, and they're friends of mine, and we still stay in touch. And in fact, The Idiot President, which is the play that you mentioned, the play that is performed in this novel, is based on a play called El Mandatario Idiota by Walter Ventosilla, a Peruvian playwright who lives in New York, who was generous enough to let me adapt his play, his allegory, for my purposes.
So what's crazy is that when I was reading the book, I was sure that everything that I was reading, I was like, this is Peru. He's describing Lima. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about this with my producer because I went back and I was like, no, it's actually Peru. And then she said, no, you actually don't name the country in the entire novel. Why not?
Yeah, you know, I didn't name the country in my last novel either. They're the same country, and if they were, they're closest to Peru, of course, because that's where I'm from, and that's, you know, Lima's a city I go back to, and Lima's very describable. You know, it's a very unique place because of the weather and because of the people and the geography,
and you describe the changes of what this ancient city has gone through just in the past 25 years.
Oh yeah,
which has it's exploded.
Yeah, and it's also you know, even in the last 10 years, it's unrecognizable, I think, to a lot of people. And especially at the edges of the city, which where the economic change and the houses have gone from shacks to, you know, three-story houses in the space of less than a decade. But, you know, I don't name it because I don't want to be tied down to anything. You know, as I'm a fiction writer, you know, what in Radio Ambulante, everything we do is fact-checked and is true. And when I write fiction, I just want to, you know, make it up.
One of the things that I love is that with this book, you really give us a clue into how community theater, a small theater company, kind of culture exists in our cities in Latin America. And it feels oftentimes in a much more organic way. Am I romanticizing this?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think it's the way it should be. I think, you know, Henry and Pata Larga, the two members of Diciembre, I wanted to say Septiembre, but Diciembre, do come out of a movement. They come out of a time where art felt very urgent and necessary, and tied into all kinds of struggles, political and economic struggles. For Nelson, you know, he's just a more typical nerdy kid who loved to read, you know, which is I identify with, you know, 110%, because that was who I was and who I am to a certain extent. And so for him, art is a much more of an intellectual exercise. Whereas for Henry and Pata Larga, it's kind of an emotional need. You know?
Well, Daniela Alarcón, thank you so much for all of your work, not only in terms of writing your novels, but also in terms of Radio Ambulante. And your new novel, At Night We Walk in Circles, is actually out on October 31st. This is your very first interview about the book. So thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for today on Latino USA. Thank you for being part of our first live ever show here in Sacramento. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Jonathan Wolf is our intern. Thanks to Melanie La Rosa for snapping photos and to Nancy Trujillo for making sure we're all where we need to be when we need to be. Special thanks to the folks at Capital Public Radio, Cal State Sacramento, including Phil Garcia, Constance Crawford, Micheline the Dean, Eric Fellerson, Jose Munjia, Jeff Medlicott, Susan Kikowski-Tatar, and Jim Molida. And to our live audience, a round of applause. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. Thank you so much for listening to Your Latino USA live from Sacramento. Gracias por escucharnos.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I've never had an In-N-Out burger. I'm going to have to reveal that. I've never had an In-N-Out burger. I'm sorry, I'm a Pollo Loco kind of girl. With my jalapenos and sal and my tortillitas, okay.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. This is NPR.